From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, state lawmakers are asking questions about the deadly explosion in West, but there are few answers, and many are wondering who is liable for the damages.
Well, there's no orchestrated plan, overarching plan to educate the public at what's in their area.
And Senator Ted Cruz, he's making quite the impression on Washington, D.C., and some are urging him to run for the White House. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. 2 weeks ago, a fire ignited at a fertilizer plant in the small central Texas town of West. About 20 minutes later, there was a massive explosion. 15 people were killed, over 200 injured, and nearly 150 homes destroyed. Wednesday at the Texas Capitol, lawmakers questioned state agencies that had oversight over the plant, but they didn't get many answers. For State Impact Texas, KUT's Terrence Henry has more.
The investigation into the cause of the fire and subsequent explosion is still ongoing, so many of the lawmakers' questions dealt with fertilizer plant regulation in the state in general, not whether or not the West disaster could have been avoided. But a telling question came about halfway through the hearing from Committee Chair Joe Pickett, a Democrat from El Paso.
Do we have the authority? Does anybody in the state of Texas have the authority to go visit these sites and make sure that whatever regulations they have to abide by, whether it's federal or state, are met?
He was posing that question to Nim Kidd. He's the Chief of Emergency Management at the state's Department of Public Safety. And he basically said, no, that's not DPS's responsibility. But the local fire chief could conduct their own inspection, Kidd said, which led to another question from Pickett.
Could you in your capacity suggest that to those local entities based on what has happened?
Kidd said yes, they could suggest the local fire chief do that, but that's really all they can do in regards to safety. That point was reinforced by David Lakey of the Texas Department of State Health Services.
Did you fill out the paperwork? Did you report what's in your facility, not whether those chemicals are stored safely or not?
That point, that we're not responsible for safety, was made by agency after agency at the hearing. One agency might look into dust and air pollution, like the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. Another might inspect fertilizer labeling, like the Office of the State Chemist. But there isn't a single agency that looks at safety and coordinating with local first responders. So what if you wanted to know if there's a plant like West Fertilizer near your home? That question was asked by Representative Ron Simmons to Steve McCraw of the Department of Public Safety.
How do these people know if there's a facility in their area that has this type of chemical? I would imagine that some people in West would have said, I had no idea.
Well, there's no orchestrated plan, overarching plan to educate the public at what's in their areas. As Chief Kidd testified, it's a local up in terms of it's not a state down.
That local up approach relies on companies to report their potential hazards to local officials and emergency committees. But those local groups don't always get that info, and they may not always adequately plan for a fire at a fertilizer plant like the one in West. Here's Nim Kidd from DPS.
And the biggest thing that I see that we can get out of this is raising the level of information and awareness to share with the population. You've got to have local elected officials and appointed emergency managers and responders that are capable and knowledgeable on their duties.
Lawmakers also got an update Thursday on the ongoing investigation into the cause of the fire and explosion. The state fire marshal said they've ruled out a natural cause for the fire, like lightning. They also said they expect to be done with the investigation by the end of next week.
Terrence Henry of State Impact Texas joins me now on the line to go a little deeper into the questions about West. Terrence, it seemed like the hearing didn't get a whole lot of answers.
Yeah, the purpose of the hearing was really to kind of look at what potential there is in other parts of Texas for accidents like these. So how many other fertilizer plants there are like West, and what kind of regulations are in place for state agencies to do safety inspections. And the upshot was is that there's not really a whole lot that state agencies can do to look at safety at these kind of plants.
So they're saying their hands are tied, but there are other fertilizer-type facilities out there that could possibly be a hazard.
Yeah, they said that some interesting numbers from the testimony that, you know, there's I think over 14,000 facilities in Texas that have hazardous chemicals in kind of significant quantities. As far as plants like West goes, there's a few dozen of those in the state, and they're generally kind of in rural areas where you see a lot of agriculture. But they kind of did have an interesting exchange at one point in the testimony where they asked, you know, if we wanted to, have we done any kind of review of these facilities and what safeguards they have in place after this explosion? And the answer was essentially no. And if they did want to do a review like that, it would basically fall into local officials, like a local fire marshal, to conduct that kind of safety inspection.
Now, they were saying, as you said in your piece, the Department of Public Safety Director Steve McCraw said that it is a local up, not a state down type of process, and they want the local volunteer fire departments to do these inspections and be aware and develop plans. Some people are saying that's not a reasonable expectation for local volunteer fire departments.
It's interesting because in the case of West, from what I've seen in the reporting, my understanding, and I believe this came up with the testimony yesterday, is that there was no, you know, fire marshal in West. There was a local fire chief, but there actually wasn't a designated fire marshal. The town itself didn't actually have its own emergency planning committee. This is a regulation in effect where you have to have a kind of regional planning committee to have, an emergency response plan in place for incidents like these. They do have a committee like that on the county level, and what people are looking into now is, did this committee on the county level in West have a contingency plan for dealing with this facility? Did that facility adequately report their potential dangers to that committee? So a lot of this is supposed to happen, like you said, on the local level. What's not clear, and actually maybe even a little more unclear after yesterday's hearing, is how much that's actually happening in Texas.
And then there's also this issue of secrecy and of awareness of terrorism, the threat of terrorism. They don't want to put out a lot of information about where these fertilizer plants are for fear that they will become targets of terrorism.
That's correct. So it's kind of a delicate balance because if you or I want to know if there's a fertilizer plant like this near our home, that information's very difficult, if not impossible, to get as a local citizen. However, those plants are supposed to share that information with these local emergency planning committees. So someone like the county judge, a local fire marshal, the mayor, they're supposed to have awareness of what kind of the dangers are in their own neighborhoods, and then to kind of formulate their emergency response plans, specifically to those facilities.
So basically an honor system on that. Have they come up with the liability? Or who will pay for all the damages?
That was another interesting part of the hearing yesterday, where the Texas Insurance Commissioner said that fertilizer plants like this actually aren't required to have liability insurance. In the case of West, they did have liability insurance, but she indicated that their policy wasn't commensurate with the risk that this facility had. So basically, if they had this much ammonium nitrate that was potentially explosive, their insurance policy, wouldn't necessarily cover the already extensive damage that's happened. The latest estimate I saw was, over $100 million worth of damage. It's going to take millions of dollars to rebuild the two schools that are going to be completely demolished. And even just the ATF investigation, they said yesterday, just that federal side of the investigation is going to cost $1 million.
So the liability is a mystery. So if I had a house in the blast zone and it was destroyed or severely damaged, who do I go to pay for my house?
That's a great question. They do have an insurance commissioner representative on site in West, I believe, and the city of West is also working with people to help them with that. FEMA is also encouraging citizens of West to apply for disaster relief, but the insurance side of this, I assume we're going to learn more about once the official investigation is released. Once we actually have answers on what caused the fire, then you're going to actually start seeing claims being filed, once they have an actual culprit.
Terrence Henry is a reporter for KUT Austin and State Impact Texas, a journalism project funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Last November, Texas elected Republican Ted Cruz to the U.S. Senate, and it appears he's already thinking about another election in November. the one in 2016, and the one that will select the next resident in the White House. It's not taking long for the Tea Party favorite to get noticed in Washington, D.C. He has a brash style that's impossible to be indifferent to. He's adopting ideological stances in the Senate that's winning loyalty points with his conservative supporters. And it's never too early to start an unofficial run for the presidency. Just ask former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Cruz's Senate colleagues Rand Paul and Marco Rubio. Alexander Burns is a senior political reporter for Politico.com and writes about Cruz's run-up to running for the White House.
Ted Cruz recognizes that he has swept into the U.S. Senate as the Republican Party's newest celebrity. And so whether or not he is actively thinking about 2016, he is clearly trying to draw out his moment in the sun as this sort of golden boy, standard bearer of the Republican right. That's why he's going to South Carolina on Friday to speak in the early primary state. That's why you see him seeking out confrontation after confrontation on the Senate floor in ways that are frankly very unusual for a first-term senator.
Some people want to know right off the bat, does Ted Cruz qualify to run for president?
The whole issue of Cruz's background and being born in Canada to one American parent, one non-citizen parent, you know, we're going to be hearing a lot more about this if he ends up actively pursuing a presidential campaign. At this point, I think it's early enough that I don't know that you have Republican Party lawyers really trying to tease out the constitutional questions involved here, but it's definitely something that people in Washington are discussing.
Is it fair to call Democrats or progressives who say that he can't run for president because he was born in Canada, are those people birthers?
Well, birther is obviously not a neutral term to use here, but if it's supposed to be just a blanket term for people who question the eligibility of someone to run for president, then sure. You know, obviously with Cruz, the difference in the questions about Cruz and the questions about Barack Obama is that, you know, Barack Obama was born in the United States. Cruz was born in Canada to an American parent. And so if we get to a point where it's important to litigate those kinds of questions, it'll be up to the judges to decide whether it's a meaningful difference.
It's quite the distraction, and people love distractions.
Yes, they do.
There was a column written in the Washington Post, Jennifer Rubin. She's, conservative, and she's blasting Ted Cruz. Don't be a jerk, Senator Cruz. So what's going on there?
Well, in private, a lot of Republicans in Washington, even a fair number of conservatives who are very sympathetic to Ted Cruz ideologically, are pretty put off by his sort of theatrical style. He is a guy who clearly likes drawing attention to himself. The way he talks about issues tends to be in this very sort of soaring, syrupy rhetoric that rubs some people in D.C. the wrong way. You know, as much as columnists may not like it, as much as Republican elites may not like it, the evidence so far is that voters are crazy about it. And I think we're going to see when he's down in South Carolina the kind of reception that this guy gets.
I can't get away from this whole idea that he may run for president. And so do people think that, given the last two Republican presidential primaries and the fact that it was really kind of the moderate candidate, who got the nomination at the end, that they think that a hard right-wing candidate could sweep through the primary process.
Part of the reason why there's so much buzz about Ted Cruz or a candidate like Ted Cruz in 2016 is this idea that, conservatives didn't want to nominate Mitt Romney. They nominated him. He lost. They didn't want to nominate John McCain. They nominated him. He lost. There is this real sense in the Republican base, particularly in early states like Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, that it's time to nominate one of our own. Whether that's Ted Cruz himself or just one Ted Cruz advisor told me that there is clearly a space for a Ted Cruz-ish type person in the field. So if it's not him personally, there's clearly a market space that someone like him could fill.
What is this doing for his campaign money raising?
Well, we'll find out in a couple months whether it's having a material impact on his fundraising. You know, the reality is that Cruz has not taken the same kind of active steps toward a national campaign, or really toward just stepped-up political activity that someone like Marco Rubio has. There's not this, kind of outside pack set up that's doing a lot of active fundraising for Cruz at this point. That's when we'll really know that Ted Cruz is serious about exploring a presidential campaign, not just something that's sort of crossed his mind, but when he starts regularly placing phone calls to Iowa and New Hampshire, when he sets up some kind of entity that will allow him to pay for his own political travel in a more intense way and starts hitting up fundraising circuits in you know, outside his capacity as a U.S. senator.
You know, when I talk to progressives about Ted Cruz's candidacy for president, they're excited. They love the idea.
They sure are. You know, for Democrats, the lesson of 2012 was that when the Republican Party pulls itself just a little too far to the right, then suddenly elections become competitive in places where they shouldn't even be competitive, like Indiana, Missouri, places where Republicans lost Senate seats last year thanks to candidates that were out of the mainstream. And for national Democrats, a candidate like Ted Cruz, who is far more conservative than Mitt Romney in most respects, the whole idea of being able to run against somebody like him as an out-of-the-mainstream conservative is just you know, a dream come true.
Ted Cruz is not warm and fuzzy. And he says what he means. I mean, when I covered the campaign when he ran for Senate, and, you know, he said exactly what he's going to do when he got to D.C., and that's what he did. So I could see why some Democrats would say, yeah, bring him on, put him in a national spotlight, because it would serve their cause.
And this really is, I think what you just said, this is why people on both sides of the aisle have pretty similar views of Ted Cruz. His fans on the right think that he is an abrasive partisan bomb thrower who is way out there on issues that they care about, and Democrats think that he's an abrasive partisan bomb thrower who's way out there on issues that place him outside the electoral mainstream. For folks on the right, that is exactly what they want in a Republican senator from Texas. I think it remains to be seen whether it's something that Republican primary voters really want to gamble the presidency on.
Well, David Dewhurst, the Texas lieutenant governor who ran against Ted Cruz for the nomination to become senator, actively said that Ted Cruz does not have the personality and the aptitude to work in the legislative process. Is that what we're seeing now?
I think what you're seeing, regardless of aptitude, is that Ted Cruz is not somebody who's particularly interested in working through the legislative process. You know, Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, told one of my colleagues at Politico in February that, you know, Ted Cruz is a person of unlimited potential, but in the Senate you have to show that you are able to make a deal. Ted Cruz isn't somebody who's interested in making a deal. The whole point of Ted Cruz is that he's not somebody who's interested in making a deal. And that's why he beat David Dewhurst in that primary, and that's why he's a potent spokesman on the right.
And now people in Texas are wondering if it's costing Texas, because he replaced Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison. She was very very good at making deals and bringing home appropriations for Texas, transportation dollars especially. Now Senator John Cornyn is busy being a leader in the Senate, and Ted Cruz is busy doing his thing. People are wondering, is Texas going to suffer?
And that's a question that Ted Cruz will have to answer in the event that he runs for re-election. This is an issue that's facing a whole bunch of Republican senators and members of Congress in both parties. Is now that you've gotten rid of earmarks, now that there's really this pox on spending, you know, what happens to folks, whether it's, you know, Kay Bailey Hutchison or Mitch McConnell in Kentucky or Chuck Schumer in New York on the other side of the aisle, who were sort of legendary for delivering for their state? It used to be that that's what a lot of voters wanted in their politician, is somebody who, you know, wherever they are on an issue like abortion or the war in Afghanistan, you know, this is a person who brings home federal money to fix potholes and build bridges. And that's really not a sales pitch that we've heard in a while.
Alexander Burns is a senior political reporter for Politico.com. He's covering Ted Cruz as there is wide speculation that the new Republican senator will run for the presidency in 2016. More than 80,000 fifth graders and 60,000 eighth graders in Texas are at risk of being held back this year because of poor performance on the state standardized test under the Texas law banning social promotion. That's according to the recently released STAR Statewide Summary Reports 2012-2013. Almost 1 in 4 5th and 8th graders failed their state math test. About 1 in 5 failed the state reading exam. These are startling numbers, and they come as the state legislature is looking for a solution to the STAR test and high-stakes testing as a whole. There's a growing understanding in Austin that the high-stakes testing phenomenon has gotten out of control and may be doing more harm than good to the state's education system. Nate Blakesley writes about the high-stakes testing problem in the current issue of Texas Monthly.
The idea was that we would start using these standardized tests, not just to see how well kids were doing, but as a way to measure how well teachers and administrators were doing. And if the kids didn't do well enough on the tests, The idea was that teachers and administrators had to be held accountable, and that's why they began calling it the accountability movement.
And so schools that didn't do well on a test got more resources, they got more money, they got more help?
Well, it worked two ways. If students didn't improve, the idea was that you were supposed to get more resources to help, but if that didn't work, then teachers could be removed, administrators could be removed, schools could even be closed. So it became very high stakes, not just for the kids involved. If the kids failed to pass the tests, you know, they could be held back in grades, or they might not even be able to graduate. But also, it was high stakes tests for all the adults involved in the process too.
And then also the system sort of evolved that if you didn't do well on a test, you started losing resources. I mean, people who passed and did well got bonus pay and things.
Right. One of the possible sanctions was if your school failed to perform well for enough years in a row, students would be allowed to leave the school and take their state funding with them. So it could actually cause a drain of resources from your school. And as you say, there was bonus pay. Programs were put into place in various districts where people would be compensated for performing well on the tests.
So here we are now. It looks like that there's been a huge turnaround, a tremendous backlash against standardized testing, looking at one legislative session to the next, totally night and day.
Yeah, the politics has really changed. You know, it's tempting to say overnight, but in fact, there's been a growing backlash against testing for years now, starting, of course, amongst teachers and administrators who felt like the tests really weren't an accurate barometer of how well they were doing their jobs and were taking up too much time and energy in the classroom. But what's happened more recently is middle-class and suburban parents have become much more organized in opposition to the test. Previously, you know, that the kids who struggled with the tests were kids in struggling districts, you know, inner city high schools, areas like that. Out in the suburbs, you know, the tests kids were worried about were, you know, AP tests and college entrance exams. But the latest iteration of our testing regime here in Texas changed all that because it drastically increased the number of tests kids had to pass to get out of high school. It required that a portion of your grade in those classes would be determined by how well you did on the standardized test. And if you didn't do well enough on a couple of tests, Algebra 2 and English 3, you couldn't get into a four-year institution, public university here in Texas. So that really got the attention of suburban parents that were in the higher performing districts.
It seems like that these are also sort of Tea Party type parents. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but these are people who are involved in the Tea Party, but they're also involved in their PTA and their schools and their classroom moms and stuff. And so they really see for themselves what's going on here.
It's a bipartisan issue, or maybe it's better to call it a nonpartisan issue. There's concern about high-stakes testing runs sort of the gamut of where you're coming from politically in this state.
But the Democrat or the lefty opposition to this high-stakes testing has been there for a long, long time. But something cracked it. Something really put it over the tipping point.
That's true. Definitely what's new is that there is organizing against the tests amongst, as you say, Tea Party types, amongst Republicans. One of the most prominent persons organizing against high-stakes testing in Texas right now is Susan Kellner. She was the former head of the Spring Branch Independent School District that's in West Houston. Her husband, Larry Kellner, is former CEO of Continental Airlines and is a big Republican donor. They are both constituents of Dan Patrick, the senator who heads the Senate Education Committee. And so there's some very powerful people now arrayed against high-stakes testing.
Senator Dan Patrick has certainly gone through a metamorphosis on his views about high-stakes testing.
Yes, he has. He was, you know, he's been on the Senate Education Committee for quite some time. He was right in the middle of this last change to the testing regime, the one that added so many different exit-level tests. There used to just be four that you had to pass to get out of high school in Texas. Now there's 15 that you have to pass. A lot of people think that that was the straw that broke the camel's back. He was right in the middle of that. And as you say, he has most definitely changed his tune. Senator Patrick is somebody who's always been very good about sticking his finger in the wind and seeing which way it blows. His political instincts are quite good. And I don't mean that in a cynical way. Probably his own understanding of the way the system works and ought to work has evolved over the years as well.
High-stakes testing also opened the door for corruption in education in Texas. We've had cheating scandals.
We have. I mean, looking back on it now, it probably was inevitable if you put such high stakes on one single test. If people's careers are on the line, if people's pay is on the line, you know, maybe it was inevitable that we would see some scandals, and we have. Probably the most notorious one is out in El Paso. There, a superintendent was investigated for contracting fraud, but what investigators also discovered is that he and some principals had engaged in a scheme to essentially force out low-performing high school kids, kids that they thought probably would not do well on the test, forced them out of school or made it difficult for them to re-enroll in school in an effort to boost scores and boost their own testing-related bonus pay.
So they boosted their dropout rate to try and boost their scores.
Yeah, that was the really ironic and sad thing about it. The whole idea behind the system was it was supposed to improve performance of kids. It was supposed to lower the dropout rate. And here's an instance in which it was actually doing the reverse.
Now, Texas high-stakes testing was exported across the country through President George W. Bush and No Child Left Behind. And so we saw some testing scandals like in Atlanta, where there was a person in another room erasing marks and fixing them. But in Texas, erasing marks, that's considered not public information, and so we don't know if that's happened in Texas.
Right. I'm not aware that we've had any sort of a high-profile investigation like the one that you mentioned in Atlanta. It is very difficult. The legislature has made it very difficult to get these tests after they've been taken. So, as you say, there might be another shoe waiting to drop there. We don't know.
So what are we going to change? What's happening in Austin with the current legislation?
Well, it seems certain that we're going to have a rollback, at least of some sort, in Texas's accountability system. We can't tell exactly now, still with about 4 weeks left in the legislature, exactly what the system's going to look like when the legislature is done, but the bill that's moving through now would reduce the number of tests you have to take to graduate from high school from 15 all the way back down to 5. It would do away with that requirement that 15% of your grade is determined by how well you do on the standardized test for that particular course, in addition to a number of other sort of smaller reforms. That bill has been sailing through the legislature. It's an open question of what will happen when it gets to Governor Perry's desk. He has been a staunch accountability advocate in the past.
Yeah, and despite all these flaws, there's still some strong acolytes of standardized testing. They're saying that we're lowering the bar, we're watering things down, and so they're still trying to come up with some sort of compromise.
Yeah, Bill Hammond is a very powerful lobbyist. He's the head of the Texas Association of Business. He has been a big proponent of standardized testing for many years and is still standing by it now. Of course, Sandy Kress, who is the former Dallas school board member who was more or less the architect of Texas's assessment system and then went to Washington with George W. Bush and helped create No Child Left Behind, has since become a lobbyist for Pearson, the biggest testing company, one of the biggest testing companies in the country and the one that holds the contract here in Texas. He also, as you might expect, has been a staunch defender of testing.
Nate Blakesley is the senior editor for Texas Monthly and wrote the article for the current issue, Crash Test, the History of Standardized Testing in Texas. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org, and you can comment on the show on the website. There are past Texas Matters programs available to listen to on the website, tpr.org. And you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.